This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. The Civil War is often referred to as the last war fought on American soil. Since then, we fight our wars overseas and we watch the battles on one sort of screen or another. For the black and white women living in the American South, the Civil War was fought all around them. The true enemy was poverty, hunger, and despair. As part of our series, North Carolina Voices of the Civil War, we're going to examine what life was like for women and children in North Carolina and the rest of the South during the Civil War. Thevolia Glimpf and Laura Edwards join me in the studio. Thevolia Glimpf is an associate professor of African and African American Studies and History at Duke University and the author of the book Out of the House of Bondage, The Transformation of the Plantation Household. Laura Edwards is a professor of history at Duke and the author of the books The People and Their Peace and Scarlet Doesn't Live Here Anymore, Southern Women in the Civil War Era. Welcome to both of you. It's great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks.
Let me start with you, Laura. White men have gone off to fight the war. They leave their women to run the farm or the plantation. What was it like for them?
Well, it was really difficult back in the home front because everything was being directed, all the material, you know, everything that people had was being directed to the war effort, to the soldiers. And so women, children at home were left to make do on their own, to do crops on their own, to try to grow things on their own, to try to keep their farms going. And most of what they produced then was being given over to the army. So there were shortages. People were hungry. A few years into the war, you start getting a lot of people who are upset and who are now questioning the Confederate war effort. And the conditions at home were really hard. In addition to the shortages, there's also a lot of political discord and there's a lot of conflict at home. So you have a state that only very narrowly voted to join the Confederacy. There's a great deal of unionist sentiment in the state, and all of that plays out in violence at home as well.
What kind of violence? You're talking about neighbors who don't agree with each other, neighbors, unionists, pacifists, and those who's in Confederates.
Yes, yes. Neighbors who don't agree with one another, who then, you know, snipe at each other, who are, you know, bringing that conflict back home and playing it out in their backyards that way. There's also violence between slaveholders and former slaves. Actually, I'm saying former slaves here because many of the slaves, as soon as the war starts, they see the Union cause as a cause against slavery. And they take every opportunity then to try to realize freedom at home from the very outset of the war. And so there's also conflict between slaveholders and slaves. And it is a very violent place, actually, on the home front.
And what's it like, Thevolia, for enslaved women in the same place in the South? What's going on with them?
So much is going on with enslaved women, and I think we really have to think about where they are from the beginning of the war to the end, and to think about what emerges as a process. I mean, the vast majority of women who are enslaved remain on the plantations. But we also have to keep in mind that some 500,000 black people left the plantations and farms. And we know that some 200,000 of them were men who enlisted. So that leaves about 300,000 women and children who are on the roads trying to find a place of refuge. And, you know, Laura mentioned, for example, how difficult it is on the home front. And white women are left to manage farms and plantations. But the work that they are managing is being done by slaves for the most part. And I think it's really important to sort of set the stage up front that what we're talking about in terms of the Confederacy is a world at war with itself. You're talking about a region of slaveholding states where the vast majority of the people are disenfranchised. 4 million slaves, 4 million women, which leaves 4 million men who basically decide to go to war. And the women at first are assumed to be going along with the process, but it becomes very clear very quickly that not only are black women not going along with the process, but white women, especially poor white women, are not going to be going along. And so the dissent, so much dissent is coming from the inside. So the Confederacy is left to wage a war, build a state, supply the home front, and keep people enslaved. It's a huge, impossible task.
And in terms of that dissent, we've got some records, particularly in the form of letters to the governor, Laura, that were sent by women who were infuriated at what was happening to them.
Right. And I have some of the letters here, and sort of to set the stage for this as well. What's happening, and these are from 1863 to 1865, and what's happening is things are really deteriorating on the home front. Women don't have enough to eat. The Confederate currency is basically worthless. So even if they have money, they can't really buy anything with it. And if they can buy, if they have money, there's nothing to buy. They're at their wits' end. And so they're writing the governor and they're demanding that he do something. And in some ways, this is just kind of amazing that these women would be writing the governor and saying, look, I'm having a problem. You need to stop this war. But this is essentially what they're doing. So, for instance, here's just one woman whose name is illegible. She could barely write herself, and it's very difficult to read her handwriting. And she says, especially for the sake of suffering women and children, do try and stop this cruel war. Here I am without one mouthful to eat for myself and five children, and God only knows where I shall get something. Now, you know as well as we have ahead that it is impossible to whip the Yankees. Therefore, I beg you for God's sake to try and make peace on some terms and let the rest to the poor men come home and try to make something to eat. And then she ends the letter saying, I believe slavery is doomed to die out, that God is going to liberate the slaves, and fighting any longer is fighting against God. And there you see her religious sentiment sort of merging with her sense of desperation, what she's seen as the apocalypse. She's saying, this is just the end. We've got to stop this. We've got to do something because we can't contain this any longer.
Certainly the frustration must have been widespread. How widespread do you think was the sentiment that the war was lost from the start and that ultimately this institution is going away?
I think the people didn't walk into the war thinking that this was going to last this long. Hmm. And I don't think they knew what they were getting into, that this was going to be a war away from home. And as Thevelius said, what ends up happening is that it really is a war on both fronts. You have to maintain peace and stability and prosperity on the home front in order to win the war on the battlefield. And they're losing the war on the home front. Slavery is collapsing. Civil society is collapsing. The economy is collapsing. There's no way that you can maintain a war effort on the battlefront when all of that is being destroyed at home. And that becomes clear later, I think.
Thevelia, in some ways, black women had to be in the same boat. If there's not enough food, there's not enough food for everybody. But in other ways, this presented opportunities for black women and men. How did that play out? How is that expressed in this time period?
You mean
the sense of opportunity, the sense that this is really a chance.
The sense of opportunity is mainly expressed by leaving. So as soon as the war begins, people began to leave. And you know, we know the story of Ben Butler at Fortress Monroe, the three men who come in and who say that their master has, put them to work on Confederate defenses, and Butler accepts them. But what people forget is that Butler also said repeatedly, I can take the men, but I have no place for the women and children. And so the women and children become the true refugees of the war. So on the one hand, they're leaving. But as I mentioned before, we have to also keep in mind that the vast majority remained on the plantations. And what they did there was to resist by not growing the crops, by refusing to work unless they were paid, by telling white women, no, you can wash your own laundry now. No, I'm not cooking for you. I'll cook for my family. And there were even some black women who took up arms against the Confederate forces. So they were looking for every opportunity they could find to wage war against the enemy, which was the Confederacy.
Did this change the relationship between black women and white women on the home front? What was it like before the war, and did it change as a result?
I think it just brought things more into the open, that the conflict between black women and white women had been there from the very beginning, which is not to say that there were not women, black and white women, who didn't get along. But the notion that they loved each other or had some commonality based on their gender is just very far-fetched. And so the war just brought everything out into the open. And you have women like Mary Chestnut saying, I'm afraid to go to bed. I'm afraid to go to sleep, because women had been murdered in their bed at the beginning of the war. And so people are afraid. White women are very much afraid. And there's one section in my book that I particularly like where the Union troops come in and the mistress talks back to them as white women have a tendency to do at this time. And her slaves tell her, look, don't do that. If you talk back, something really bad is going to happen. So they're speaking from their own experience of talking back and knowing what happens. And so they're sort of protecting her, but we can't read that as loyalty to the Confederacy.
On the state of things today, we're talking about North Carolina during the Civil War, particularly what life was like for women and children. Thevolia Glimpf and Laura Edwards from Duke are here, and our conversation will continue after a short break. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking about women and children in North Carolina during the Civil War with Thevolia Glimpf and Laura Edwards, history professors from Duke, part of our series called North Carolina Voices, the Civil War. And before the break, we were talking about the Civil War being really the South at war with itself in a lot of ways. Protest also is beginning to grow. Here's a system built, an economic system built on male patriarchy. The men are away at war, and the system begins to break down. There are letters to the governor from white women asking for an end to the war, and black women as well, Thevolia.
I'd like to share a letter from Charlotte Ruhl, who was a white woman from North Carolina, who also wrote to Governor Vance. She described herself as, quote, an old widow lady that has a great many servants and other property and has no person to attend to any business at all for me. And so what she wanted was the release of her husband to take care of her business and her overseer. And she said she had no one to tend to her business or to protect her servants, except for her two daughters. And her property, she wrote, had been going to destruction. So what we have here, again, is an example of how the Confederacy was coming apart from the inside, with women who were poor, or even in this case, she's not so poor because she has property, but she has no man to take care of them, and her overseer has been called into service. And so these women were expected to be the backbone of the Confederacy, and instead they turn out to be, you know, part of the destructive component.
Because they're not all Scarlett O'Hara. And I mean, maybe that's the other point that we should raise here and talk about what, particularly in North Carolina, what life was like for women. It wasn't all terror.
No, and I think that a lot of people, when they see the Civil War in their mind, they imagine terror. They imagine Scarlett O'Hara. They imagine these big plantations. And in fact, North Carolina was not like that at all. It's a much more middling state. It was very unlike South Carolina, which did have those large plantations. North Carolina, for the most part, did not, with a few exceptions. And so most of North Carolina residents are middling sort of people. And there are a lot of also poor people as well. And they expect their leaders of their state to fulfill certain obligations and to maintain sort of a decent standard of civil peace. And that begins to completely crumble during the war. And they get very angry at the leaders of the state for precisely that reason. What they see is complete disorder. And this is not what a government is supposed to do, which is why they're also writing to the governor and why they feel like they have a right to be angry, is because the government is not fulfilling its obligations. So we go from 1863, where you have, for instance, a woman writing. This is actually from Georgia, but I like this particular letter, and it captures sentiments that were in North Carolina as well. And in 1863, things are just economically bad. And this woman writes, I don't know what we will do to keep clothes and something to eat, for these old speculators will starve us to death. I wish we'd get them all in a regiment and send them to the Yankees. And I know that they would stop the war, for the Yankees could not stand their charges either. So she's just upset at that point. And she has a sense of humor, which I think sometimes we forget in thinking about these women. But by 1865, people have really had enough. And there's a woman who writes to Governor Vance, and she is writing from Greensboro or near Greensboro. And she says, I have threatened for some time to write you a letter. A crowd of we poor women went to Greensboro yesterday for something to eat. We had not a mouthful of meat nor bread in my house. And what did they do but put us in jail in place of giving us anything to eat? So
jail.
You see the anger. This woman wants the government to help her.
Were there protests? Why was she put in jail?
She was put in jail because they were demanding bread and meat, and I imagine they probably stepped over the line and perhaps grabbed some up as well. She doesn't own up to that, but that well could have been the case. But she's claiming, you know, certain standards from what government should do to protect her, and it's not there for her, and so she's willing to actually, you know, rebel.
Were there organized protests or organized activities that would have amounted to resistance?
Yes, there are bread riots. People go and seize provisions. People also, there are instances in North Carolina where women are running particular local authorities out of town because they feel like they're not doing their job. So there's these sporadic kinds of protests throughout the state, especially in 1864 and 1865. And there are also threats from soldiers. There's desertion, threats from soldiers to go home.
Are things any better for women who were wealthier when the war began?
When the war began,
certainly,
because they still thought they could depend on their men, and they still believed they could depend on their slaves. But very quickly, they are writing saying, you know, the men are gone, the slaves want work, and so they begin leaving, and they become what many historians call the first refugees of the war. And so poor white women become very upset because they don't have the resources to move, to get out of harm's way when the enemy comes in. And so the tension, the pre-existing class tension between poor white women and wealthier white women exacerbates during the war because white women who are wealthy can get out of the way, but very soon even they have no place to go because the Union Army is virtually everywhere.
Yeah, Laura.
And there's also class tensions between the poor white women and the wealthier white women because as wealthier white women, even though they are becoming more and more poor, they still have access to more resources than poor white women. And so when they do stay, there is continuing tension. And you get letters as well to the governor where you have, for instance, this one woman is asking, can Mr. Moore throw me out of my house? My husband has paid the rent. And why can he throw me out of the house now? His son got to stay home because they have property and he has to take care of the property and my husband has to go away. Surely he can do something for me. So there is this sense of, it comes out in the open more. Existing class tensions in North Carolina become much more volatile and visible.
Do these tensions carry over in the aftermath of the war and the political and social restructuring that occurs after the war?
Yes, absolutely. In North Carolina, a lot of those tensions are recapitulated in politics, and politics becomes very volatile in the post-war years. And a lot of poor whites defect from the Democratic Party and move into the Republican Party, and there is a biracial coalition there. And I think that it underscores the extent of class tensions during the war that carried over into the post-war years. And so definitely that affects the whole entire social and political climate after the war as well.
And I think that the sight, the very sight of poor white women and children lined up to get government, federal government rations in 1865. Remember, the Freedmen's Bureau is the Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Lands. And so the federal government is feeding thousands of white people, which is something we also forget. And so I think that very sight again said to white people in the South, look, this Confederacy was not only a wartime failure, but the legacy of that failure still haunts us. These women whose men had gone off and lost their lives. And in North Carolina, especially in the mountain areas, you know, the white women who are Unionist are beaten. They are hanged until they almost die by Confederate forces because their men are Unionist. And so those kinds of experiences have to carry over into the post-war era. But that story still needs to be written, I think.
What about women who were they active in hiding deserters from the war for the Confederacy?
That's why they were beaten and whipped. And their children were whipped. One woman was captured by Confederate forces because she refused to say where her husband was. And they took her child and put it on the snowy ground and made her just watch while she couldn't go to the child, a baby, really. And so there was a great amount of violence and abuse. And the Confederacy could not answer people, you know, why is this going on? You were supposed to be there to build a new pro-slavery state in which all white people would be superior. And look what we've got.
But in the aftermath, women aren't going to play a very important role in politics anymore. So did what happened to them matter to the men who would now take control of the apparatus?
Well, it's, I mean, we tend to think of politics like the war as being something that involves men only. And yet it's not really the case in this period where politics is about a wide range of social relations, involves women. Even though they might not be able to vote, they certainly have definite ideas about how society should look, and they certainly talk to men, their menfolk, about all of that. So to think that women are excluded from politics in the post-war period, I think, is a mistake. It's also the case that women were very much involved in all of the kind of political battles in the post-war period. So when the Klan comes riding through and burns down the houses of white Republicans and African-American Republican leaders, they burn down women's houses and destroy their property as well as men. And it is no coincidence that a lot of that political violence targets homes and households where women and children are, that women are very much involved in all of that. And women are also involved in remaking the South. And I think one of the things we forget about is that this period is a time of hope, too, for people who felt like, especially African Americans, who felt that they're coming out of slavery. They now have a chance to remake their lives. And yes, the situation is pretty dire, but on the other hand, there are possibilities here. And so African American women from the outset are very involved and very definite about forming families, about bringing, you know, lost family members together, about making households, about building new community institutions, about making sure that there's education for children, about making sure that they get paid for their labor. And they're active in bringing these complaints to the federal officials who are available in their area, to the Freedmen's Bureau, who sets up soon after the Civil War during Reconstruction, and also then to local courts after the passage of the 14th Amendment. So they're also involved in that kind of political reconstruction of the South as well.
Tell us a little bit more about that, about court activity, the idea that freed women were now very active in the courts trying to secure their rights, their newly won rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, rights, passage of the 14th Amendment happens, but you obtain rights by actually claiming them on the ground. And this is what people do on the ground in North Carolina in their daily lives, and African Americans in particular, from 1864, even before passage of the 14th Amendment, which granted civil and political rights, at least in theory, African Americans are trying very hard to create a more expansive vision of freedom that involves a wider array of rights. And what they're doing is extending and expanding and trying to claim things that they didn't have during slavery. So as slaves, African Americans can't even have a legally recognized family. They can't get married. They can't organize. They can't own property legally. And so claiming all of those kinds of rights, women do and men do following the Civil War, and are very active in trying to make that a reality.
Thevolia, you talked about the number of women who stayed on farms and plantations during the war, black women who stayed. Were they also active in imagining, perhaps imagining, but in creating some of the institutions? What will happen to us if we get our freedom, and should we begin planning for that and creating the institutions, educational and otherwise?
Yes, of course. In places where, for example, black people were able to carve out enclaves of freedom, like the Lowcountry of South Carolina, New Bern in North Carolina, Alexandria, Virginia, and where there were what we call contraband camps. These were places where you could begin to rebuild families, where you could establish schools, and you had black women coming from the North to help in that process, along with white women. And so that process begins during the war, but it's not until after the war that they can really move to claim those rights. And it's a very, very difficult task, because even though there's the Freedmen's Bureau agents are army men, and they're not really inclined to really help black women. Rather, they see them as not really women. They see them as women, but women who, unlike white women, should be forced to work. So it's a totally different gender kind of analysis when it comes to black women and children. And the Freedmen's Bureau officials are constantly complaining that the women won't work, that they're going back into their homes, when in actuality, what black women are doing is trying to build a kind of political economy that would allow them to be with their children and at the same time make a living. So it's very difficult. But the groundwork is built in places like Alexandria and Freedmen's Village in Washington, D.C. And there's a large effort underway today to bring recognition to those contraband camps, make them part of the National Park Service, for example.
Laura?
When you realize what these women are working against, their efforts are just incredibly heroic. So there is this one woman, one case that I really like a lot, and this woman is, her name is Bella Newton. She lived in Granville County, North Carolina. Her children, in order to go to school, had to cut across a white neighbor's yard, land. And the neighbor didn't like this for many reasons. I'm sure also because this woman's children were going to school. And one day when they were coming home, he assaults them, essentially, and he exposes himself to them, which is a very symbolic act and very sexually threatening. So the children go home and tell their mother. And the mother then tries to go over and resolve the conflict with the neighbor. He says, you know, no way. And then ultimately she goes to the local justice of the peace and she files charges of assault against him. And she gets an indictment against her neighbor. But this is 1870. And when you think that this woman had been a slave, her children were not legally hers before this. They could not go to school. And she could not use the court system. And now she's able to go and do this. She's able, but it is an incredible battle, and the courage that it must have taken to do that is also pretty incredible. The payout, though, is to define yourself and define the terms of your own life, and that is also something that is, you know, priceless.
Courage and awareness, Devolia, that there is this system, and this is very important. So we're not just sort of passively waiting for Washington to hand us these things. People have been watching, waiting, and imagining how they can use these systems in order to access them. The minute they have a chance.
The minute they have the chance. And if you read the Freedmen's Bureau records, North Carolina, for example, one bureau agent writes, Mandy wants her daughter. John wants his wife. These are people who are being held still as slaves after the war is over. Women who are taking to the road to locate children who were sold to Mississippi or Alabama. It's tragic on the one hand and also unbelievably courageous, and it testifies to the humanity and dignity of these people. And the Freedmen's Bureau simply was not equipped. There were not enough men. Too many of the men did not support what these women and fathers were trying to do. But black women and black men and their children said, basically, the meaning of freedom in this country is not expansive enough. It has to change. And they worked to make that happen. Unfortunately, the movement against that expansion of the very meaning of freedom came quickly enough, and the Bureau was shut down, the troops were withdrawn, and black people were left to their own defenses.
And it sounds like one of the great tragedies is while black people were imagining themselves in the future and a future of freedom, in the aftermath of the war, there was still a lingering imagination or idea about what black people should be doing, what their role should be. And if it's about working in the fields, hard to imagine the new world and what they would look like if you're in the Freedmen's Bureau.
And they kept saying to Northerners, missionaries, and to Bureau agents who said, will these people work? They said, look around you. Who built this region? Our blood, our sweat grew the cotton, the sugar cane, the tobacco. And you want to know if we can work, if we know how to work. And so it was pretty silly to them that the question was even broached.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program today. So great to talk with you, Thevolia and Laura. Thanks for being
here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thevolia Glimpf is Associate Professor of African and African-American Studies and History at Duke University, the author of Out of the House of Bondage, The Transformation of the Plantation Household. Laura Edwards is a professor of history at Duke University and author of the books The People and Their Peace and Scarlet Doesn't Live Here Anymore, Southern Women in the Civil War Era. Coming up after a short break, Quakers in North Carolina during the Civil War. Stay with us.